19 Uniform, thank you, descend flight level 110.
0, Shuttle 19 Uniform, join 28 Romeo Yankee, we're climbing flight level 70 on the Otago departure.
Emirates 6 Oscar Bay, continue your right turn on navigation now to Dulles.
Blue Messenger for Victor Hotel, turn right heading 325.
Hello and welcome to For Flying Out Loud, a podcast that aims to inspire, empower and help all of our listeners to dream bigger. My name is Andrew Neofitu and I'm super happy to be your host again for this exciting episode. Now, I consider myself somewhat of a traditional pilot. I quite like the wings on my aircraft to remain stationary. Of course, this traditional fixed wing Wright Brothers tech is useful most of the time, but you can't stop in mid-air, sadly, with some notable exceptions, of course, that my current listeners will know all about. In this episode, we are going more Da Vinci than Wright Brothers and getting stuck into some crazy helicopter action. Not just that, but we're going to hear stacks more about the capability that helicopters deliver to other teams, especially when things go wrong. This episode of For Flying Out Loud is brought to you by Skychaser Aviation Recruitment, expert support to deliver motivated and committed pilots around your bespoke needs.
Bristol 809, all flow by Roger, and a copy flight time closing time 0 for next report before lifting.
Welcome, thanks, Bristol 809.
My guest and old friend developed a flying career after leaving the military, having completed multiple high-intensity tours in conflict zones such as Afghanistan and Bosnia with an elite army unit. In his two fascinating working roles today, he has an unparalleled view out of the front windows, both as a North Sea helicopter captain flying for Bristow, Norway, and in his work as a mountain rescue medic in the Scottish Cairngorms. We'll be discussing Si's journey through his military career to his flight training and dual careers of flying and mountain rescue. I'm personally blown away by the skills, the passion, the drive and the resilience that has enabled him to succeed, and also the fascinating philosophy crossovers from aviation to the medical world. So let's get started. Simon, welcome to For Flying Out Loud. It's great to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andrew. It's a pleasure and an honour.
And I think that's probably the first time I've ever heard you call me Andrew, Simon.
Yeah, there's a lot worse things I could call you, but yeah, it's...
of course, you know my other name because we go back a long time.
I, for the viewers and listeners who don't know, I know Andrew as Scrabble, or at least Andy, but more usually Scrabble, which was his call sign in the military, so...
Yeah. Absolutely, Scrabble, because yeah. My surname Neofitu would allegedly score quite well at Scrabble. Actually, I don't think it would. I think there's too many vowels and it actually wouldn't score that well. But Simon, thanks for very much. Curler is your nickname, I believe. We won't go there.
we'll definitely not go there.
Something to do with a game, I believe. Curling, yeah. Right. Simon, I always start this podcast out with people that are pilots and just get stuck into what got them interested in flying. So what was it for you that got you interested in flying?
Yeah, again, it's for everyone, it's probably a culmination of many things. You know, there was a bit of flying background in our family. And again, that was through the Royal Navy from an uncle of mine who then joined Bristow Helicopters. So from a very young age, it was something that we were always quite familiar with. And that was all helicopter related flying operations. And then, you know, growing up, I always knew about that. But of course, I wanted to join the military as well. So I did the Navy flying aptitude test down at Cranwell along with a bunch of other guys and was actually offered pilot, but I turned it down, which is probably quite unusual. Yeah.
Do you know, I don't think I ever knew that. Why did you turn it down at that stage?
Yeah, well, there was just other things I would wanted to have done. And, you know, I started out in infantry for a couple of years as an infantry soldier, went to university, joined the University Naval Unit, similar to yourself with the Air Force Squadron. So that took me down a naval kind of path. And I kind of thought about flying. I thought about the hydrographic survey, things like that. But I wasn't quite sure quite what to do.
Yeah, so you're a bit of an enigma there, because most people, if they pass the aptitude test, be like, right, I pass him. I've been off a pilot, fantastic. That is my dream. I mean, that was it for me. But of course, you didn't. And you and I, as you were sort of alluding to there, both joined the Royal Navy. So you, I did join as a pilot and you didn't join as a pilot. So what did you do in the Royal Navy, Si?
Yeah, so I initially joined as a warfare officer. So that was that's the officers who pretty much man the warships, fight the warship at sea and do all the navigation and operating the ship as it should be operated in conflict and in peacetime operations. But very, very soon after that, life at sea, I thought probably wouldn't be able to fulfill what my desires would be. And again, it leads into the strange story of what I actually ended up doing in the military, which was the special duty type role. So I was actually approached while I was a warfare officer by a couple of guys in suits and said, you'd be very well suited for a little unit. And I didn't actually know what they were talking about. So I had to go and talk to the first lieutenant of the warship that I served on. And I told him, these two chaps approached me and told me what I should do with my life. He opened up a safe and showed me a couple of documents about the said unit. And they kind of planted a seed for me. And from then on, it just burned away in my brain. I thought, maybe I should give this a try.
Wait a second. I'm putting some things together here. So I'm thinking Royal Navy,
yeah.
Royal Navy officer, secret stuff in safes. Are you James Bond?
Please don't go there. not at all.
I'm now thinking of new nicknames for you, but this sounds really cool. Yeah. Of course, we did join the Navy. I think we joined in the same intake back in whatever it was, 96, 97.
Yeah, I think you're one intake ahead of me or something, a couple of months ahead.
I am that old. Yeah, it was at least 25 years ago, which makes me want to throw up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I knew none of this sort of stuff, this change from warfare branch to other stuff, which I want to talk a little bit more about.
Of course, you were very busy at that time with your flight training. And I remember on the phone many times, you know, various bases where I was, you know, chatting to you and which stage you're at and at the Hawk and Anglesey and what you were doing. And, you know, concurrently with that, I was cracking on with what I wanted to do. So I do remember speaking to you for all those different phases. But I mean, for me, that, you know, once the seed was placed, I knew I needed to train hard and I needed to acquire a lot of skills that I wouldn't be able to get in a warship. So I put into transfer to the instructor branch that would keep me ashore and that would give me an opportunity to train with all the kind of skills that I would then need if I wanted to go further on to selection. So, and that's what I did. I was lucky enough to be able to transfer to the instructor branch, and that enabled me to get some very, very good instructor training, which has stood me in good stead my whole life, I've got to say, and also to then chip away at the military skills that I would then need to become an effective member of that unit that I had set my heart on joining. And that's what I did. I ended up, I was working with the Royal Marines and I was getting all my skills and drills, you know, up to speed and went on selection. And one thing led to another. And before I knew it, I was in places where I never thought I really should be.
This all sounds incredibly demanding. My total exposure to anything like this, pretty much, well, aside from a brief, I think it was about 2 weeks stint, and in fact, you may have been one of the people involved in this, the combat survival course that all air crew had to do.
And
that's about my that and watching TV shows like SAS Bourne Survivor or something.
Yeah, indeed.
That's about all I know.
I think I remember seeing you coming through a SMAC course actually at HMS Sultan. I remember. And so, of course, before I went away and did my advanced stuff, you know, I did little courses in the military, like the, you know, the interrogator course and things like that. I was a conduct after capture instructor and things like that. So, you know, that enabled me then to get a great insight into the early lower end of human intelligence type work, you know. So,
all right, that was the week I was there. Yeah.
A skinny, dishevelled looking wreck crawling across it. No, not at all.
But you know, I found it really interesting, that course, because it's amazing. For those listeners out there who don't know anything, and there's quite a few, about military selection and military flying training, when I went through training, I don't know if it's the same now, but we did this two-week course, and it was all about surviving if you happen to eject behind enemy lines and escaping. And they call it escape and evasion training. And then that culminated after a couple of weeks of this sort of not very much food and lots of walking and lots of getting very cold. So as he said, a skinny, dishevelled wreck. I look like one at the best of times. But But I remember then getting interrogated. But and it's amazing, you know that it's not real, but it sort of seems real. And talking of being real, actually, you may have heard, Simon, because I know you listen to the podcasts, that I interviewed former Tornado navigator John Nicol, whose latest book actually talks about not only his ejection and conduct after capture, but also several other crews. And I'm pretty glad I did that course, even though I actually never ended up A, going to theatre, or B, getting shot down. But so you did that at the beginning, and then what happened then?
Interestingly enough, about what you just described, the pilot of that aircraft that shot down, he was one of the guys who was on my conduct after capture instructor's course, where we were in.
Oh, wow.
It allowed us to debrief a guy who actually was captured. And we spent quite a lot of time, you know, debriefing him, and he would describe to us the duress that he was under and the different circumstances. And for us, as becoming conduct after capture instructors, that was really beneficial for us to then learn the mindset of being captives. And so then we would go out to I would go to the Royal Marines then and train them all in the resistance interrogation and that kind of stuff, conduct after capture, and what will happen to you and things. So it's not a very nice thing to know about or have to do, but for prone to capture troops and people who are at the front end, it's a possibility for all of us. So.
Well, it's essential knowledge, and it's something actually when I talk to aspiring military pilots about joining the armed forces, and a lot of them say, you know, oh, I don't know whether I really want to do it. And you know, usually most people know what they want to do, but I say, well, put aside any thoughts you have about the sort of the cool Top Gun aspects of it, which is why I joined, because there are other things. You've got to be prepared to put yourself in harm's way. You might have to be prepared, sadly, to put other people, to help other people to put themselves in harm's way. And and things can get pretty real, as we know, sadly. So did you ever find yourself in harm's way, Simon, in any of these sort of roles? I know you probably can't talk about a lot of them, but it'd be interesting to hear what you can tell us.
When you think of the several years I was involved in that kind of work, you know, we were from some of the early troops into Afghanistan, early 2000s, you know, right at the beginning of all that, you know, and for example, lots of moments in the Balkans and other places. There's too many to mention. You can imagine I've served, I think it's 6 war zones in my time. So a lot of hours, days and moments where you're literally shaken, and you look left and right at your buddies, and they show you their hand trembling as well, and kind of just that look says, yeah, I know, buddy, I know, we just got to get through it.
Wow. I mean, it would be interesting to say more about this, but even as close mates, and there's not a lot of stuff we can't talk about, certainly not on the airwaves, but that sounds pretty intense.
I seem to remember when you and I met last, I think we were doing ATPL ground school or something together, and we swapped photographs. Do you remember? You were showing me your first night deck landing on a flat top carrier, and I was showing you pictures of me dressed up like a scarecrow deep behind the lines doing something, and the two of us were saying, goodness me, I wouldn't like to do what you did.
I should add that I haven't ever done a night deck landing. There are many more talented Harrier pilots out there than me that did.
Maybe it was just a day deck landing, but for me,
it's pretty. And I just thought, what are you doing dressed up like that, Simon? I didn't know you were doing any of this stuff. So how did that sort of time in those what sound like pretty interesting roles change or help to define who you are now?
I think, Scrabble, you know, those 2 or 3 years doing that work, you know, you've really spent a lot of yourself to get to do it. You know, you really have to dig deep physically, mentally, and then when you're out on operations, you're you know, each day and each night when you brief and everybody's frightened and worried, and you know, you've gone out and done a mission and it's been pretty hard. You see a lot of crazy stuff, but then coming back in the next night when you have to brief and do another mission and go out and deploy again. And then the next night and the next day, you know, you're digging deep into reserves where you actually didn't think you had anything left to give. You know, you've got your, you know, your finite level of, you know, let's say we call it your bottle, you know, your resources of bravery and resilience. And over the weeks and months of operations, that ebbs away for many guys. And then, you know, you get to learn so much about who you are and what makes you, what drives you. And so at the end of that, you realize that you're a pretty resilient, robust kind of person, that and you can deal with a lot more than you maybe thought you ever could. So for me personally, what that gave me was when I completed a lot of these missions and a lot of the that element of my life, I looked forward and thought, you know what, whatever I want to do now, I will try and make it happen, and nothing can stop me when I put my mind and my body to it. So, and so far, you know, touch wood, so far, you know, that philosophy and that resilience has stood me in good stead.
Yeah, you know, I chat to another friend of mine who's also done some of this sort of stuff, and he says it's so much more about the mental approach to things. And as you say, you know, how much can I take here? How much, and you're going beyond those reserves that you thought were possible, but most of it is inside your head.
Yeah. For example, you know, I've been on, duty in a foreign country where I'm way, way behind any other support elements, and I'm doing observation. A couple of us, two of us lying around looking disheveled, and we got long lenses and we're looking at guys for many days at a time. But there's been times when, you know, you've run out of food, you've run out of anything else, and you know that there's no extraction capability. So, you know, you've gone many days without any food or anything left, but you just got to dig deep and stick with it, and either extract yourself or hold fast until you're going to get extracted. And so, you know, things even like that, you know, I have nothing to eat. Well, okay, we had nothing to eat yesterday. Just crack on, you know, you're going to get through it. And
doesn't sound particularly enjoyable.
But, you know, all these funny stories about cold, wet and miserable and stuff, you know, it's just physical discomfort. You know, it's all these things that you can work through, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I will always be eternally grateful. I mean, no organisation is perfect, but I'm extremely grateful to the armed forces for shaping who I am today.
Yeah.
And anything that I've been lucky enough to do well at, or my business endeavours, you know, I owe a great debt of gratitude to the armed forces.
Yeah.
And to my oppos in the armed forces for, you know, telling me to wind my neck in every once in a while, give me a pat on the back when things were done well, and that sort of camaraderie and that approach.
Yeah.
I think it is pretty unique. I'm not sure it exists anywhere else in the world, to be honest with you.
No, I absolutely agree. I think, I'm very much a military type of guy, and I can't speak highly enough about the mechanisms of training regimes and the how it engenders and develops esprit de corps and the camaraderie, and the tribe that you're in is your brotherhood, your tribe, and you'll do anything for them, and they'll do anything for you if you get the right tribe. And there's nothing quite like it.
Absolutely. There's a great book actually called The Chimp Paradox, where they talk a lot about a tribe and how beneficial that is. And I think in the military, you genuinely do get to become part of that tribe. And without talking too much on this subject, I think my mates now, like you and lots of people I've interviewed on this podcast, they're mates for life. Other friends come and go, but military friends don't tend to. They tend to always be there.
Yeah, we've shared a lot, you know, over the years. So, and that sticks with you, even though we're, you know, apart around the world doing all sorts of things. You know, that kind of shared common core values and stuff is invaluable.
100%. So, but you did all this really cool stuff, but I want to get stuck into the sort of flying aspects of it in line with the podcast today. Yeah. But we won't get too geeky on this, but I want to know sort of how you came to the idea then, although you'd had family members in Bristow, how did you come to the idea of becoming a helicopter pilot?
Yeah, so ultimately, you know, after a lot of these tours of duty that we've just been describing, you know, it's it was definitely time for me to move on. And I looked around, and I had a very dear cousin of mine. He's kind of more like a brother, and he was actually operating as a North Sea pilot at the time, and that's the son of my uncle, who was a Navy diver and a Bristow winchman. So that's the family business, was Bristow, since I was a young lad. So I thought, well, if my cousin Kieran can do it, then I'll give that a shot as well. And, so that the kind of aviation thing probably never went away from having done naval aptitude testing and stuff at Cromwell. And I just thought, I'll just do it. It sounded like a very challenging role for me. And I thought I would rather like it. And that was it, really.
Doesn't sound that challenging after what you were just telling me.
But again, you know, you look into it and you think it's very expensive to pay for yourself to train. And, you know, there's no guarantee of a job at the end of it. So for me, it was a huge commitment. And what I did is I worked, I left the service, the military, and the next day I was working for a government organization that sent me overseas again to do more work for them. In the, so then that helped pay for my flying. I then did private security work using all the skills that I learned.
James Bond. The more and more you say, the more I think there's going to be a movie. I hear that Daniel Craig is retiring soon. I think there's room for a bearded Irish gentleman.
A bearded has-been. No, I don't think so. But that literally paid for everything, mate. And the way I looked at my flying career, I thought if I was going to have to be out a lot of money to do it, maybe I wouldn't do it. But luckily for me, I had the skill set that the military give me. I was able to use that, and that paid for my entire flight training. And again, you're looking at courses to do. I thought, will I go to America? Will I stay in the UK? It was more expensive to go to UK school, but I hadn't been at home for years and years. I'd been deployed and overseas so much. I thought this is going to be my first year at home. And actually it was idyllic. Yeah. You know, I commit myself to flight training like I was on selection. I was just every single day, I had my kit squared away. I had my study done. I was at school doing my flying, doing my self-study. That 1 year was super intensive. And the school I chose was fantastic in Aberdeenshire. And I just thrived. I absolutely thrived on the challenge of becoming good at the skill of flying and to learn the knowledge that, yep, I didn't have. And so it was, to me, it was actually a very thrilling year of my life.
It sounds to me like the military mindset really helps you with this training.
Yeah, actually, the little school that we trained at, actually, when I look across the little tribe of students that it had, we are now all around us like chief pilots, chief training instructor captains and all sorts. So the little school, it only had 5 or 6 students, and we all did jolly well out of it. And the boss of that school was a retired police commander with an extremely strong work ethic and very kind of military disciplined approach. And I think we're all very, very grateful to him. And then in the same way, he responded to my discipline as well. And it was just a very good symbiotic relationship.
How hard is rotary training? I mean, you've obviously not been through the fixed wing training route, but is it, it's probably a bit of an enigma because most of the people that I help at Flight Deck Wingman are applying to airlines or flight schools to become airline pilots. Yeah. We do help some pilots that want to be helicopter pilots, but how hard is the rotary route? Do you think it's tougher than the fixed wing route?
Interestingly enough, I don't know if you remember as well. So when I left the Navy, and I was I went to America to do my fixed wing PPL because that's what I used my resettlement for. So I got my fixed wing PPL in California, and so that was like 55 hours or whatever of flying. So I did like the basic minima, and then I did night ratings and stuff there and flew around California. But then I thought, yeah, that's okay, but helicopters might be better. And then I came back to Scotland and did the rotary training. And I got to say, having done the fixed wing and then the rotary, it doesn't compare. I took to the fixed wing flying relatively okay, it was no big shakes, but the rotary flying really challenged my brain. And it was really a fascinating, thrilling journey, you know, to hover the aircraft in a little field and be given what each control one at a time. And the guy just says, now keep it simple, try and keep it in the field. And then within a couple of hours, you're not only in the field, but you're in the right place in the field and so on. So you've mastered that skill of hovering and you really feel quite proud of yourself. And it's something that never goes away. I hover every day in my job. I'm hovering over decks and over all sorts of things day and night. And it's still, there's nothing that we have in our helicopter that's going to let you hover better. It's you, your eyeballs, and you're stirring the sticks.
I spoke to, in fact, Rory, who will be listening to this because he edits the podcast, has appeared on an earlier podcast episode. Great podcast, people, by the way. The Podcast Coach, if you're trying to get your podcast edited. There you go. Free plug for my friend Rory. But we chatted about helicopter flying because he was going through commercial helicopter training and spoke very briefly. I had to have a go at about 5 hours worth of helicopter flying in a squirrel.
Yeah, I'm sure I remember
you know what that is. Yeah. Si. And I thoroughly enjoyed that flying.
Yeah.
And compared to hovering the Harrier, flying the Harrier. And in fact, Richard Browning from Gravity Industries said to me, it's probably great when you're in the bar talking about it afterwards. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. But when you're doing it on the Harrier, I was so maxed out, totally maxed out all the time. And not that you can't get maxed out, particularly doing what we're going to chat more about in a moment, the sort of flying you do in helicopters. But I thought, do you know what? Part of me wishes I'd gone and flown helicopters because I loved it. And I felt like I had just the right amount of capacity to find it challenging, but still love doing it. So I guess you still get that buzz right now.
Yeah, definitely. You always do. And no matter what helicopter type you fly, there is something special about, rotary flight, I got to say. And it's never too late. You can always crack on and fly a little Robinson around or something.
You know, it's funny you should say that. I have been thinking about it, but it sounds hideously expensive and I'm not sure I'm good enough these days.
We've got simulators as well. You can have a pole around in a simulator.
I'll definitely take you up on that one. So you actually, as we said, chatted about at the beginning, you actually now work for Bristow Helicopters. So anyone that knows anything about helicopters will have heard of Bristow Helicopters.
Yeah.
Tell me more about Bristow and what it's like working for them.
Yeah, so again, I was lucky enough. I did my flight training. And again, as soon as I finished, I was asked by Bristow, could you come to Bristow and do an ops officer job? And if you do well, we'll get you flying. And so that was a kind of a really nice gentle way of being introduced to Bristow. And so up I went with my bulled shoes and my starched shirt, and they were like, yep, you'll do. You look like you know how to. So I did 6 months as ops in Bristow and then straight into flying the Super Puma 332L, which is, the Super Puma. It's a fantastic machine. I flew that for a couple of years and then went on to the 225, which is it was one of the most advanced helicopters in the world, probably still is. And then finally onto the Sikorsky S-92, which I currently fly. I've flown that for about 4 years. So Bristow Helicopters, it's the biggest rotary company in the world. Probably it's got about, I don't know, it's 800 odd pilots in the globally. We're in all areas of the world. And I'm currently operating in Bristow, Norway. It's a really fantastic privilege to fly up in Norway.
You say they're based all over the world. So for people that don't know anything about it, what sort of operations does Bristow get involved with?
Yeah, so there's about 60% of the business or something perhaps is oil and gas transport. So it's transporting workers to oil and gas platforms around in the sea. And that's globally all around the world and using all different types of helicopters. They're also very big in the search and rescue role. And in fact, Bristow was a textbook model where they took over the entire running of search and rescue operations in a country, which is the United Kingdom, a few years ago. So that's a really good success story where, they took that over from the military role and civilianized an entire national search and rescue. So, and of course, Bristow have pedigree of doing search and rescue in Britain anyway, since the early 80s. So there was a time in the world, Andy, where Bristow had a Sikorsky 61 called Oscar Charlie. It was the most advanced, sophisticated search and rescue helicopter in the world. It was the first aircraft to use the FLIR, the forward-looking infrared. Quite a good pedigree.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And what is the... I think I've actually sat in an S-92, Sikorsky S-92, visiting another friend who worked for Bristow, but it was quite a while ago now.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and going... to use a sort of military phrase, this is Gucci. This is really nice. It was more like an airline cockpit than what you'd imagine you'd find in a helicopter.
It pretty much is nowadays. I mean, when I said, back in the day when I started, I was flying round dials on a 332L Super Puma. So it was round dials like a Spitfire, and you were very much plugged in to it yourself. You did a lot more of it in the old-fashioned way. But, very quickly we had the 225, the... which is, full glass cockpit, the same as the S-92, fully EFIS glass cockpit. We can fly, coupled ILSs and PBN approaches right down to minima, just like any fixed-wing airline. So, we can literally fly the thing hands and feet off for much of the time. And it is very much monitoring your EFIS screens, the CRM element, it's all very much more in line with the fixed-wing kind of cockpit that you're familiar with. So it is quite automated, and it can be, even though it sounds like, we're going out to landing on ships and pitching seas in the middle of the night, which we do, we can also come back to airports and do full, ILS and PBN approaches. approaches. And for example, in Norway, it's kind of all PBN approaches. So we're doing, you know, LPVs down to minima, things like that, you know.
Wow, amazing. And so your role is an oil and gas helicopter pilot. So you're flying out to oil and gas rigs, presumably.
That's correct, yeah. So the S-92, we'll take maximum 19 passengers, and we'll fly them out over the sea for 100 miles, 150 miles, and then drop them on an oil rig or an oil platform or a ship or a diving support ship. So it could be a really small, sometimes it can be like a ship that's three times the length of the helicopter, and you're landing on a bow deck.
Wow.
And it's pitching 6-7 meters in sea and rolling 3 or 4 meters either side. So, you know, and the deck is, you know, a 22 meter deck for a 20 odd, you know, meter helicopter. So it's, you know, it's pretty, pretty special.
That sounds exciting and terrifying in equal measure.
But the S-92 is it's the same length as a cricket pitch. You know, it's nearly 70 feet long.
Is it really? Wow.
So it takes 19 passengers, two pilots. You know, it's a pretty big piece of kit, 26,500 pounds max all up weight, which is about 12 tons, you know, imperial
tons.
It's
like a game of top trumps, this, Simon. To go 787 versus Sikorsky S-92. Minimum speed of an S-92.
We can hover, mate.
Exactly. I'll beat your maximum speed.
You probably will.
Well, the maximum weights, it sounds amazing. What are some of the sort of really tasty, you think of any sort of standout moments flying to the oil and gas rigs or boats and you really stand out as a really challenging day?
Again, you know, in my role now in Bristol, Norway, we get to fly in all the bases that we have. We fly out of Stavanger, Bergen, Flora, which I currently operate in, and then right up in the extreme north in Hammerfest, which is, you know, it's higher up than Murmansk. You know, it's right up at the top of Norway, extreme north Arctic operations. So that for me is a real privilege as someone who's a, you know, an Arctic expeditioner myself. We'll probably come on to some of that later. But, you know, my natural habitat is about 70 degrees north in the Arctic tundra. So for me to get posted there for work is just a privilege that I can't tell you how grateful I am and how nice that is for me. So, you know, and that entails flying north up towards Spitsbergen to rigs in the Arctic Sea there, and the wildlife, the marine wildlife there, and, you know, the reindeer when you finish work for the day running about the mountains. It's a real privilege. So, but nonetheless, you know, when you're working up there, for example, it's extreme north operations, and it's very remote. We've got to carry our own search and rescue helicopter at locations where we are there. So they are our only means of rescue if anything should happen. So wow, that's pretty extreme, you know. But conversely, you know, going back to my early career in Bristol in the UK, where, you know, we had such a varied role. You know, we used to take an aircraft and a couple of engineers and just fly over to the west of Ireland and operate there, supporting drilling operations in the Atlantic. Or, you know, you'd be part of a winching crew, winching, doing flare tip inspections, or, you know, doing photographic sorties constantly to photograph the flare tips and all that. You know, it's multi-crew, you got winchmen in the back, and it's really, really enjoyable CRM environment, and very challenging for you as well to hold a hover for 30 minutes whilst the you know, the guy with the camera is taking thermal imagery of how the flare tip of the oil rig is decaying and when it might need replaced and stuff. So that's, it's really good kind of roles. And also when we had aircraft that were US unserviceable on an oil rig, we'd be asked to go out and winch spares and technicians down and, you know, do things like that. So it's super interesting, rewarding work, actually.
Is there one day you can think of where you go, I earned my money that day? I mean, I'm sure there's lots of days, but there's a one day where you go, yeah, I really earned my money.
Well,
that
for
day.
For us, you know, Scrabble, that's winter flying at night. You know, that's when, you know, there's plenty, yeah, of summer days in Norway, 24 hours a day, sunlight, and it's beautiful and really, you know, it's a privilege. But the dark winter nights and the flying conditions there with the lightning and the thunder and the hail, high seas, storms, that's when your the game face comes on for sure. And that is when, at the end of a sortie, when you come back having landed on the deck of something that's moving dramatically, and you come back in and you sit with your co-pilot and you say, right, any lessons from tonight, or how did you think he did? And, you know, you have a debrief there and you think, you know, we nailed that tonight and we were on our game. So it's very, very challenging. It's exacting. The discipline has to be there, and it's very, very appealing for people like us.
Do you know, I think the most challenging, almost extreme scenario I've been in recently is having too hot a cup of tea delivered to me on the flight deck. That's about as challenging as it gets these days.
I guess it is slightly a different role, but, you know, isn't it strange? You know, we hold the same license. You know, that's the irony is, you know, we both hold an ATPL IR and we both operate in a multi-crew, heavy kind of commercial airline industry. But, you know, it's so different when you think of the daily tasks that we do. You know, I could be low level in the fjords one day trying to land on a rig that's run into the fjord to escape weather. And you got, you know, built, you know, mountains all around you, potentially wires, all sorts of threats and hazards. Another day it could be, you know, major snowstorms to avoid or high seas. And the decks, of course, are moving like mad sometimes. So we do have some good challenges. And of course, we fly with like 20 kilos of gear on us. You know, with layers of survival gear on, we've got a diver's oxygen tank on our strap to our chest, and I mean, we've a lot of gear on, so it's actually very fatiguing. It's a very noisy environment as well,
and a vibration. I mean, I jest, of course, the airline world. Well, everything's designed to be safe in the world of Bristow, of course, it is, of course. But you know, I'm regularly flying 230 odd people. Big distance and a big jet full of fuel, and you know, some days, as you say, you know, challenging weather, cold weather operations, other environmental factors, you know, long days, long nights. Yeah, you know, it is a challenging role. I don't think it comes quite as near to the challenge of I've got a window, fortunately, obviously, from military flying to know that some of the types of extra challenges aviation can bring. But I feel really lucky to, you know, I like it when there's a challenge. Yeah, actually, yeah. makes all that hard work going through flight training worthwhile.
Yeah, for sure.
If you're looking to recruit talented and committed pilots for your operation, then put your trust in SkyChaser Aviation Recruitment. Within 1 year, and during a pandemic no less, SkyChaser has already started to change the face of aviation recruitment, delivering a personalised service to clients and candidates alike. As the world prepares for what we hope is an end to uncertainty, and as we look to the future, SkyChaser is determined to help aviation operators and pilots get back off the ground and into the skies. SkyChaser, compassion for its candidates, capability for its clients. Find them on LinkedIn or at skychaser.aero. You're not just a helicopter pilot. You're not just done all the other cool stuff before. You're never going to retire, by the way, I can tell. You're also involved in mountain rescue, in a mountain rescue role.
Yeah.
So can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so again, it's another very, very large part of my life. These last 9 years I've been doing it. So again, everybody who knows life in the United Kingdom, you know, England, Scotland and Wales, you know, knows that we got big mountain areas. And we also know that lots of people come to a bit of bad luck occasionally on the mountains. But I'm in the Braemar Mountain Rescue Team, which operates in the kind of southern Cairngorms of central of Scotland, you know, the Highlands. So that's all part of Scottish Mountain Rescue, which is the Scottish organisation that has 25 rescue teams, I think, at the minute, operating in a similar kind of way. So. Yeah, I mean, that's a calling for me, you know. I'm so passionate about that lifestyle. And as you well know, I've always been a mountain kind of guy, you know, outdoors and running and climbing and gallivanting on the hills. So
I think your Instagram channel, I won't mention the full name, but it's something mountain something or other.
It is, yeah.
I am mountain weasel or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, I'm definitely a mountain guy. So, but yeah, so I mean, you know, I the way that my team, the Braemar Mountain Rescue Team, operated, you know, for a few years, people knew of me and knew that I was running about the hills. And I was approached again and said, why aren't you in the mountain rescue team? And I said, well, I can't, I'm too busy and I'm a pilot. I've got a small family and I'm too busy. And they were just, you know, they'd kind of wore me down after a short while and I ended up joining it. And I wish I'd done it a few years previously. And, you know, I used to think, you know, I've done lots of military stuff. I'm quite glad and satisfied with what I did in the military years. But I always thought I would wonder if I could ever have been a mountain rescue guy. And I never thought it would actually happen. When I was at university in Aberdeen, I used to see the mountain rescue team operating. Sometimes I was in the mountaineering club. I was climbing hills all the time through university. And on the occasion, you'd have a glancing encounter with the rescue guys. Everybody would just look at them and go, my goodness, that's those gnarly, you know, rescue guys, you know. And I didn't think I could ever do it, to be honest. And but, you know, life is strange and you never know where you end up. So, you know, that's what I've been, that has filled my time this last 8 or 9 years. And, you know, I spent more time probably doing that than what I do at work. It's more work intensive than my work as an airline pilot, helicopter pilot. So it's extremely rewarding work, you know.
What are some of the things would you say that have helped you become this mountain rescuer from your previous career?
If you look at, you know, what I did in the military, you know, obviously pretty fit guy and got a lot of skills in the military. I did a lot of medical type training in the military to work in these advanced kind of specialist units. Right. So by the end of that time in the service, we were all of us kind of operators were pretty, you know, pretty skilled in advanced and trauma type techniques and stuff. So as a civilian then, when I joined the rescue team, with a lot of that skill that I had, I took the kind of mountain rescue equivalent exams, which is actually a unique qualification in the UK. In the mountain rescue community in Europe, we're the only people actually in the UK. We can give all the drugs that a paramedic can give on the ambulance. So we can give opiates, morphines and fentanyls and things like that. So it's a very, very privileged skill and qualification to have, which enables us to be up in the mountains and stabilize very sick casualties, because we could be with them for hours, of course, up on the hill before a helicopter can come and get them, or if the weather's too severe, we're going to have to stay with them or move them. So in order to do that, we've got a lot of skill to stabilize and relieve the pain of a casualty as well. So
wowzers. Are there any sort of aspects? It's pretty obvious to me how the sort of military side of what you did crossed over into this role, but any sort of crossover elements from being a pilot that you think, obviously you've flown out, I'd imagine some, not always, but sometimes you've flown out in search and rescue helicopters.
Yeah, so again...
Is that how it works?
Yeah, in Scotland, you know, the kind of model would be that, you know, for just taking it, stripping it back a bit, you know, the police are, they have primacy in all mountain rescue in Scotland, so they command and control all rescue operations on the mountains. So, and then we fit in as rescue teams. So taking my area, we've got like 40 odd people in the team, and they're all skilled in a almost like a military patrol. We've got a cadre of vehicle experts, we've got a cadre of medical experts, we've got a cadre of, you know, abseiling and rope specialists. So together we all bring the skills that we have into the team, and everything we do is as a team. You know, alone one person is not that effective, and we do everything that we Absolutely. Do as a team. So, and then aside to that, we got the Bristow Helicopters, which is the operated for the Maritime Coast Guard Agency. They operate the search and rescue platform for the helicopters, and there's 10 of those bases around the UK. So we would usually use the Inverness search and rescue aircraft. But often the Scottish weather dictates that the aircraft probably can't get into to the casualty because it's such bad weather, the clouds down. And then we would use the helicopter to uplift sticks of our rescuers, two or three or four at a time, and drop us higher up the mountain with all our equipment. And then we can then get into the casualty and sort them out, either stretcher them down below the cloud base where the helicopter can uplift them, or stabilize them some other way. But often we do use the helicopter. It'll winch us into the area or winch us out again. So very often we're involved in very close working with the helicopter, which is actually very, very rewarding for me, because a lot of the guys who fly it are my very good mates from many, many years, and my cousin Kieran as well flies it.
So it must be really cool.
Yeah, it's quite, because I jump in the helicopter, I put the headset on and come up to the cockpit with the boys and all right lads, and then I mean they fly in some
not you again
they fly in some terrible
take
conditions
a day off. Take a day off, Simon.
Yeah. But they fly in really, you know, I take my hat off to them, you know, because they're trying to get us in there, and there's times when you know, there's turbulence and it's really bad conditions nighttime, and we all know that it's extremely challenging, And I really just look at them, the two of them, as they're trying their best to fly, and the two winchmen and the winch operator at the back are giving the commentary about, and you're just sitting quietly between them all, thinking, just let me out of this helicopter. I'll walk from here. That's fine, you know.
And they're probably you're thinking, God, what are you guys doing? You're nutters. And then you get out, they're probably thinking, what a nutter.
Yeah. But what's very interesting there is that, again, because of my, it's kind of unique because I was at the time we created the search and rescue contract in the UK, I was the only Bristol pilot who was also a mountain rescue guy.
Really?
So that meant that it was a really interesting place for me to be at that time, because I could then advise the mountain rescue guys, I could then advise the Bristol guys. And it was kind of like, you know, learning, teaching both camps a little bit about the other tribe, you know. So the mountain rescue guys would say, why does the helicopter always do this or that? And then, you know, Bristol would ask, why do you mountain rescuers always need to X, Y, or Z? And I'd just be able to just, you know, backfill the information to each camp. So it was really fascinating.
And you actually said to me before we started this recording, you work in an advisory role now, including things like avalanche scenarios and all that sort of stuff. That sounds really intense.
Yeah, I mean, previously, you know, in the early days of the operation, you know, as they were taking over from the military role, there was, you know, within our group and within my team, there are some extremely experienced individuals who have done mountain rescue for as long as we've been alive. You know, they are absolutely, you know, encyclopedias when it comes to avalanche response, for example, or, you know, cold weather operations. So there was a time when, you know, when Bristol were saying, you know, it would be good to know a bit more about where we fit in with a helicopter in an avalanche response. So I went to the team and asked some of the guys who are, you know, literally legends in avalanche response. And then between us, they were able to develop some protocols that we could then go back to Bristol and say, you know, that this is what happens at an avalanche, and this is where the helicopter would fit in. Because, you know, there may be things that we need the helicopter to do which is more important, and the priorities are such that we might need to get a search and rescue dog to come in and search the avalanche tip before they go and do something else. Or we would want to keep them on station as opposed to let them go away with a casualty to hospital, or, you know. So that is just a way where we just we're able to develop their understanding of how they fit into the jigsaw, you know.
Yeah, crikey. And presumably, although the search and rescue sort of helicopter pilot role would appeal to you, it doesn't, because then you wouldn't be able to do the mountain rescue role.
Yeah, I think, we must have spoke about that before. I mean, there were several times in my career I had the opportunity to probably go and do search and rescue. But at that time, it probably meant that I would go away from where I lived and spend a lot of time at a different base in a different place. And it would have probably taken a lot of my time away from the rescue team. And I got to say, you could probably gather, it's my passion is to be involved in rescuing souls on the mountains. Like we've just been describing, I've done a lot of different things in my life, and there's nothing quite like, you know, being there when someone really needs you on the mountain. And we all, you know, it's really quite a privilege, you know, a very humbling thing to be someone's last hope, you know.
Well, people are relying on you. I promise not to be one of those people that goes walking in a pair of trainers and a T-shirt on a day and then gets cold and wet and crying for mum. Presumably, you know, you are people's last hope. That sometimes there is no other way of getting there. The helicopter might not be able to get there. You know, as you said before, maybe the rescue, the incident scene is in cloud and the helicopter just can't get there. So you and the team are the only people that can get to them. And are there any sort of rescues that really stand out as a memory for you? You know, ones that maybe ended with a positive response, or tragically those that perhaps didn't?
Yeah, again, you know, many years of doing this role, and of course there are those that have done it a lot longer than I have and much better stories than I have. But, you know, certainly, you know, over a few years there are, you know, there were instances that come to mind that there was a time in a winter we were told that there was a guy missing overdue up in the winter mountains. And, you know, as soon as you hear it, your heart sinks, because you know there's a storm building and you know that it's that, you know, the challenging conditions of the mountain. We are all, you know, most of the team are qualified mountain leaders, you know, so we can get paid for carrying out that role of leading expeditions and stuff in the mountains. We spend all our time in the mountains. We know how challenging it can be. So when you hear that someone's gone out, it's, you know, your heart sinks because it's 60 mile an hour winds, snowing, and it's negative temperatures, and you just hope that they've got the right kit and the right skill set to survive. So, but you know, one incident that I remember well was we were told that we had to go out and search for a guy, and again, everyone was, you know, closing the doors and putting the curtains down because the storm was raging, but we knew we had to shoulder our packs and get out up the hill and try and search for this guy. And of course, you know, I remember his daughter was interviewed at one point about, you know, how things were going, and she, I remember her saying, you know, she's got no, she can do anything, she can't do anything else, she must all her hope lies with us now. And you know, it was a very moving thing for me to hear and to think about. I've never forgotten that, you know. And we searched so many days for that guy, and eventually, actually, he was found months later. He had been avalanched up in the mountains, and obviously he didn't survive. So, you know, that's the sad times that we have to deal with sometimes.
Yeah, emotional times. I can see you're emotional now. So I mean, you know, yeah. Obviously I've not been in that that kind of situation before. But you know, people are relying on you. It'd be easy to forget that A, you and the team are putting your lives at risk, presumably on several occasions.
Yeah.
And B, how this sort of emotionally affects you guys going out there.
It's, yeah.
You know, people rely on emergency services and mountain rescue teams to sort of come and rescue them. And as you say, last hope. But you know, I take my hat off to, you know, if there's ever, there are so many worthy charities out there, but for me, you know, if there's ever anything like Mountain Rescue Charities or the RNLI or something like that, then, you know, I think, you know, because a lot of them are hideously underfunded and they're crewed by volunteers that are doing this, you know, out of the goodness of the heart.
Well, that is a strange thing. We are, you know, we are all volunteers. We don't get paid for that work as Mountain Rescue, and, you know, we are charities, so we rely on donations from the public for all of that, although the government...
What would be the charity name, Simon, if people did want to make a donation to the Mountain Rescue team? How do they do that?
Yeah, well my team is the Braemar Mountain Rescue team, but it's so I mean all the teams are the same, they're all charity teams at the minute. So, but you know, all teams receive some funding from the government as well. A limited amount goes for equipment and things like that, so, but they are generally standalone charities. So, but you know, the like you say about, you know, it affects us, you know, and again, you know, in the selection for becoming a mountain rescue operator, let's say, you know, all of that is put into, you know, it's all considered, you know, is the guy fit? Is he hill skills? Are they developed enough? You know, has he got the robustness and the mental strength as well? Because like we say, you know, we deal with fatalities and very... you know, bad situations sometimes. So, you know, all of that is considered when you volunteer to become a mountain rescuer. So, but there are happier stories as well, of course. You know, there's guys, you know, a lot of climbers in the central Cairngorms, you know, climbing big hills. We've got 1,000-foot cliffs up and down the Cairngorms. And there are some times when guys just run out of rope and ideas and night overtakes them. And, you know, they could be very good climbers, very experienced, and just, you know, they could be leading someone who's a little bit slower. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and each pitch takes a bit too long. And before they know it, it's pitch dark. And then that's it. They've literally, they're cragfast. And then we get the call and out we go. And, you know, often some of us, you know, I'm a skinny little guy. I can sometimes have 2/3 of my body weight in my rucksack and extra ropes and all sorts of gear where you think, my goodness, I'm not sure I'll stand up to this. And then you spend the whole night rigging up complex rope systems and getting abseiling down to them and getting them and then lowering them the whole way down the cliff. And evacuating that way. So that's a whole night's worth of work. And once the casualties are secured, then you got to pack up all your gear and yomp off the mountain. And that could be 25, 30K off with 2/3 of your body weight through the dark. So it can be very challenging.
I can imagine. I bet some of those people are like, you know, I'm saying, oh God, I'm mortified. I don't know why this happened. This is awful. But, I'm so sorry.
And again, we're not, presumably, you know, we don't judge any of them. We're there. We go out to help when someone needs help, and that's what we do, you know. And we go to all sorts of skiing accidents, climbing accidents, you know, people who've broken their leg, falling over. I mean, and you know what? The strangest thing about being a rescuer over these years, you look at every step you make on the mountains and you become much more cautious as a person, because you look around, you think, that would be so easy to slip there. I'm just going to You know, it's so amazing. I've become totally risk averse now when I'm skiing and everything. It's because I don't want to break anything.
Yeah, and it must be great to see that synergy of the search and rescue helicopters coming in, the mountain rescue team coming in, and everybody just pulling together to achieve this objective. I don't think there can be anything more satisfying. And most people in life don't ever get to witness that. I mean, you might witness it, I suppose, if you're a casualty.
Yeah.
But you don't get to feel what it's like to be part of that team. But that synergy must be amazing.
It's a really amazing environment and very thrilling to be a part of. You know, you can see how it all, you know, because we, you know, we carry the police radios with us. So we're very privileged. We get all that access, the command and control element, and then watching the helicopter come in, do its stuff. And that we know how it all fits together. We all have our skill sets, and you know, the vehicle troop have to get us there sometimes. And as soon as they've done their task, navigated well, done the vehicle management, we jump out as the medics and we get stuck in with our medical role. And it all just fits together. It's just, as you say, the synergy there is fantastic. And again, you asked me earlier about what pilot skills, you know, I can bring to that. Well, getting back to that, this is becoming a bit like a Billy Connolly sketch where we're jumping to different things and coming back in. Yeah. But, you know, again, as a pilot, this is a fascinating role. And the things that we do in our day-to-day life that we take for granted almost, and that is we operate under highly stressful situations, like I've just described, yes. Night landings on an oil rig. And not only that, you know, 6 monthly OPCs, LPCs in the simulator where we have to do our, you know, 6 monthly checks. I mean, that can be 8 to 10 or 12 hours of simulator time where you're, as you know yourself, you're getting put through your paces
well and truly.
You know, it's very exacting and demanding, and we're constantly under the pressure to do well and to keep your reputation high. You know, we fly every day on our reputation with your co-pilot, with your colleagues, with the engineers that you work with. So all that stress is, and the intercommunication that we have to get right, you know, we're privileged. If you unplug from the aviation world and then you look at, for example, the medical world that where I work in the mountain rescue role, you realize that not everybody has the benefit of training in the soft skills, the CRM type skills, the human skills that we take for granted now at this stage. So I look at a high pressure situation where there's a sick casualty, someone who needs our help, and we've got a team of guys. And you know, the body language that how we conduct ourselves around the casualty, how we talk to one another, how we manage the stress. You know, that's all. I take all that from the aviation world.
Very familiar territory to me as well. Hearing that, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. If you look at key CRM type skills that we take for granted, you know, like, you know, for example, in Bristol, we've got one that says, know who to communicate with and when, and things like that. You know, when is the bad time to interrupt or to say, or, you know, when to bring your co-pilot up to the same script as you if we're getting a bit, you know, under pressure and stuff. All these things that we know how to do, I can then use in that rescue role. So it is really fascinating. The use of checklists are coming into medical scenarios now where, you know, we can free up bandwidth if we just take the checklist out and it's nothing to be ashamed of looking at a checklist before you administer a drug or something. You know, that's a key skill that we would, you know, I would look at someone I fly with, if they didn't use a checklist, I'd look at them a bit funny and go, do you not want to use a checklist? Yeah. And so it's you know, if it's frowned upon in our aviation world where we wouldn't do it, so why wouldn't we be proud to do it in the, you know, the trauma, pre-hospital, emergency care world? So these are fascinating.
Absolutely. Hey, I know you listened to the recent episode that I did with Richard Browning of Gravity Industries, known as the Jet Suit Man. A thoroughly nice guy, super down to earth, considering everything that he's achieved. And for those of you who haven't listened to that episode, go and check it out. He flies around in this jet suit, and I know that he's been using it and developing it in loads of areas, actually, special forces type work. There's a video of him launching off a rib in the sea and landing on a ship, HMS Tamar, I think it was. And also he's been using it for paramedic type roles. And there's a great video of one of his team flying up I think it's somewhere in the Lake District,
yeah,
flying super close to the rock face.
That's right.
Where do you see that sort of tech integrating perhaps in with what you do? How might that be used?
Yeah, again, I mean, I've, like many of us, I've watched Richard Browning developing that suit for several years now, and literally in awe of the developments there. And again, looking at it with, you know, using it with the commandos, with the Royal Marines, it's fantastic to see that being utilised. And again, only after listening to the podcast with yourself and I actually started thinking about how we could utilise it in, up in Scotland, for example. And a number of years ago, I was involved in the project to introduce drone operations into Scottish Mountain Rescue. And we did that successfully. And there are some teams using drones. And of course, they do have limitations. But they can, like all the pieces of equipment in Mountain Rescue, there's one day or one night that piece of equipment will come into its own. You know, we have 1,000-foot ropes in our rescue team. Well, we don't need them every day, but there's one dark night we will need them. And the same with the drone search, it could be useful. And now looking at the jet suit, well, do you know what? If he says you can bolt it on and be airborne in 1 minute, you know, there's plenty of times when the...
I think he said there was, I forget the start time of the jet engines. I'd have to listen again. I'm not going to quote them in case I get it wrong and get in trouble, but it was seconds, not minutes. And I saw him put it on. It's really quick. Yeah.
I know you went down to visit him, and that sounds thrilling indeed.
Yeah.
But
It was epic to see it. Yeah.
But I definitely can see some form of role with that. You know, if you can have the ability to, when you're dealing with a rescue, if someone has, a major problem that they need to get stabilized quickly, and if we're down below the cloud base, you know, wondering how we're going to get up there, it's going to take, 45 minutes, an hour to yomp up there with a lot of kit. And the helicopter can't fly because it's in the fog or whatever other reasons, turbulence. You know, perhaps there's a role of strapping that thing on and
just whazz up the cliff face.
Up.
The jet
yeah,
seat,
yeah, so it's definitely something.
Amazing.
To explore.
I'll put you in touch.
Yeah. You'll have to do that. Yeah.
And we'll see how good your hovering really is with jet engines this time.
We'll see.
Yeah, but there'll be lots of banter to be had, I'm sure.
As long as you start me off in a large field and tell me just try and keep inside the field, and I'll be fine.
Well, he's actually, I went down to visit it last week, and he's got this training rig down at Goodwood, which is really cool. It's basically a big sort of, scaffolding type affair with some straps that he can attach to people. So even if they lose control, They don't eat the big one.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's really, really cool. Simon, thanks. I mean, it's so interesting hearing, all of this synergy stuff. I'm going to move now into the area of the podcast you'll be familiar with called the winging it section. Always difficult to say winging it. I don't know why I called it that, really. But it is the Flight Deck Wingman podcast. Yeah. So, right, are you ready for your winging it question?
I'm ready.
If you could speak to anyone, alive or dead, who would it be and what would you ask them?
Oh, goodness. Off the top of my head, winging it, I would have to say Sir Ernest Shackleton. And again, we look to him for his endurance and his leadership. By endurance, we conquer, all the things that Shackleton taught us by his years in Antarctic explorations. I think he's still today an inspirational character. His leadership and his management of a team in adverse situations, I think we can all gain a lot from learning about him.
Yeah. And what would you ask him then? Anything in particular?
Yeah, I would probably ask him how miserable was it man-hauling the James Caird, which was the little boat that when the Endurance got stuck and trapped in the ice and sunk, and they had to drag that little boat, the James Caird, across the ice until they found water. Then they had to get to Elephant Island, and then they had six of them had to row that and sail it to South Georgia to save everyone.
I think I know what his answer would be, Simon. I'd hate to break it to you, but he probably said something like, pretty miserable.
I would want to ask him, how deep did you have to plumb to your reserves to get through that epic operation? Quite something.
Yeah. Incredible. They didn't have the kit, of course, that
Absolutely.
You've got these days to get about things.
Yeah.
So we're going to wind this up shortly, but I've just a few more questions I'd like to ask you, really. Because it's an alien industry to me, really, but are there any sort of changes to the rotary sort of commercial helicopter pilot industry that you'd like to see?
Changes? We changed aircraft type through the generations, let's say, and, we fly... we're always looking for a new type, a better type to fly. And I guess for us, we're hoping in the coming years there are some new types coming on the market for us. And my company, Bristow, we're looking at VTOL and actually eVTOL aircraft, which are maybe smaller and, you know, and VSTOL as well, you'll be familiar with from the Harrier times, you know, short takeoff and landing.
Indeed.
So we're looking at things that look like, for your listeners, the Osprey, for example, you know, big tilt rotor aircraft. So
incredible aircraft.
Yeah, so we're looking at things like that in the near future and getting quite excited about that, you know. So that's probably something that... That will be nice for us to look forward to. Other things I could say, you know, I think I spoke to you before about it. You know, it's a very male-dominated industry still, and we can't quite understand why.
Aviation in general is.
We just don't understand why. And like I think I said to you before, I think in all my years, 15 years flying for Bristow, you know, I can count on one hand the female pilots that I've flown with. And, you know, there's absolutely nothing that should preclude them from having a great career of doing this role and, you know, doing any aviation role. So we just don't see a lot of females coming through.
Yeah, it's a big subject, actually. And of course, as two blokes, so we're not best placed to understand all of the reasons why. But I really spent quite a bit of time thinking critically about this challenge, because I'm passionate about all sorts of minority groups within the aviation world that we don't see much of. Yeah. Female pilots, pilots from black and minority ethnic groups. So I'm really passionate about it. And in fact, there's a one of the earlier podcast episodes on For Flying Out Loud. Yeah. It's called Redraw the Balance, Women in Aviation International. And we chat about a lot of the reasons that most men never really give any thought to, about why there aren't. So we don't understand why, but actually we should be trying to learn why.
Yeah.
And I covered quite a few. So it's a really cool episode to listen to if people would like to go and check out that episode. And I know you've got two daughters as well, so perhaps you'd be able to get one of those flying a Bristow helicopter at some point in the future.
Actually, you know, strangely, over their lifetime, you know, they're kind of like teenage girls now, and over their lifetime, they've been exposed, of course, to all things military, all things aviation, and all things medical. And the oldest one, she's absolutely devoted to becoming a doctor. That's, I don't know, it's a role that you have in the family as well. So, you know, she's from about 8 years old, been super committed to be to just that's all she wants to do, and you know, she's got that.
So we need to get her trained up as a doctor, and then trained up as a pilot, and then she's a flying rotary helicopter doctor.
I do tell her sometimes, actually, in the you remember in the Royal Navy, you do have you know, professional doctors who are trained pilots as well to do all the aviation medicine. So I did tell her that, but we'll see. Time yet.
Wherever she goes, I'm sure it'll be awesome. Simon, what do you think the future holds for you now? There seems like you've achieved so much. What do you reckon the future holds?
Yeah, it's always a good question, isn't it, really? And, you know, here we are in kind of mid-40s or whatever. And like you say, I'm quite content with where I've got to. And actually, I never thought I'd get to do half of the things that I did so far. And, you know, when you think what, for me now, I think it's a nice time to enjoy where I am in life. You know, it's we spent so much of our life, and you remember the same. You know, we strived so hard to achieve our goals and our dreams, and we burnt ourselves out doing things. You know, really expending a lot of energy and to get where we got to. And I think maybe, I don't know if you're the same as me, but the strange, maybe it's a failing for us, is that we no sooner had we achieved something that was quite all right, that we just kind of dismiss it and crack on. What's the next thing? What else can I do? When can I? And you know, you go through your 30s and 40s just on a trajectory that's, you know, you're doing really well, but you don't stop to reflect and
never stop and enjoy the moments. Yeah.
People around you would say, oh, it's really amazing. No, it's, I need to do something else, or there's something else I need to do. But I think it's important to just dwell upon the two marching paces sometimes and think, you know, you get to a position where you should just enjoy what we're doing instead of always looking ahead, you know, and maybe that's the age we're at, or maybe that's where we've got to.
We need to sit down, and I know a good place to do it, because you live in a Boyne, which is a mecca for mountain way flying in gliders. So I am going to make it a mission to come and sit down and stop for a couple of days. We both have to stop. if we can find if we find it within us, and just enjoy a few whiskies, maybe go and take a glider flight, not with the whiskies, and just reflect on everything. Absolutely. Yeah. Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate, to talk to you and to learn all about, well, like, massively varied career, not just in aviation. So, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's so much to talk about. And like you just illustrate, you know, it's one thing having an aviation career, but, you know, there's plenty of additional things that that can fulfill you and that you can strive for in parallel of your aviation career. You know, never stop, you know.
Absolutely. Thanks, Simon. And thanks to everybody for listening. If you enjoy the show and you want the episodes to keep coming, please consider showing your support and buy me a coffee. You can find a link in the episode description. I'll be super grateful. Thanks, Simon.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Great to speak to you.